Welcome everyone to Edgy Leadership Radio. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and my goal in each episode is to bring you the best in professional practice for your work as a school leader. I'm joined today by Barbara Blackburn, expert on rigor, and I want to say welcome, Barbara. How are you today?
Oh, I'm great. How are you doing, Justin?
I am fabulous. Thank you. So, Barbara, you are known as a leading authority on rigor in K through 12 schools, and I wonder if we could start by having you talk a little bit about rigor and the misconceptions you see, because rigor is a word that everyone's familiar with. Everyone believes that what they're doing is rigorous. What are some of the biggest misconceptions you see around rigor in the schools that you work with?
Well, I think the biggest misconception is the concept that rigor is more, whether that is more homework or more problems or a longer assignment. And that is definitely not what rigor is. I mean, frankly, with a homework assignment, if they can't do five problems, they certainly can't do 10 or 15. And it just adds to the frustration. Mm-hmm. And when you really look at rigor, rigor is about going more in depth, which sometimes means we're doing less in terms of quantity. So I think the biggest misconception is that rigor is about quantity when it's really about quality. I think one of the other big misconceptions about rigor is that it's only for certain students. For example, I hear all the time that, you know, our honors students are working at a very rigorous level, but other students are capable of working at increased levels of rigor, even special needs students. So I think it's very important that we look at rigor for all students. One strategy that I know that a lot of schools use is to increase rigor, is just to move more students into honors classes. And although I think that's one strategy, I think that can't be the only strategy. Some students simply aren't prepared for that level of work. And the other reason that I think that we need to pay attention to rigor for everyone is that if we only look at it with honors students, we're telling every other teacher they're not capable of rigorous instruction. And as a former teacher of at-risk students, I really have a problem with that, because I think that every teacher in your building can teach at a rigorous level. They may need more training, they may need a better understanding of rigor, but everyone can teach rigor, and every student is capable of rigor. So those are the two biggest misconceptions that I see in the education community today.
Well, thanks. Yeah, and I know we're legally not allowed to go more than 3 minutes without bringing up Common Core. So why don't we go there? And I'm thinking about particularly the cognitive load and the depth of knowledge issues that we're seeing more and more schools grapple with. And as you said, you know, it's not just something for honors classes. It's not just something for the one teacher who has the honors classes. Rigor is an everybody thing now. And how are you seeing schools react to that change? You know, what are some of the things that you see, people struggling with or first kind of discovering when they start to see themselves as people who are responsible for helping everyone access rigorous content and do rigorous work?
Well, I think one of the challenges is that each teacher I meet says they have high expectations for students. Mm-hmm. And every administrator I meet says they have high expectations for all the students in their building. But sometimes our actions don't match up with our words. And so, for example, I was talking to a teacher a couple of weeks ago, and she said that she had high expectations for all of her students. But then she immediately followed that up by saying that she didn't think her students could do the Common Core because it was so much more challenging. Well, if we have high expectations, we really begin by saying they are going to be able to do it with my help. Hmm. And I think that's a key part of rigor also, is we have to understand that it's not just setting the bar higher, it's helping them get there. Mm-hmm. And so I do think expectations, particularly those hidden ones that we have, are a real challenge for teachers. And then I think another challenge is just understanding the standards, not just what the standards say, but what are ways we can meet that, where we meet the students where they are, but take them to those new standards. And I think a lot of that is professional development. A lot of that is simply having time to work in the standards. But a good piece of that is understanding what rigor really looks like for students in the classroom, because just having rigorous standards isn't enough.
Right, right. And I think we've probably all been in professional development where we've heard that the way you help all students do rigorous work or access rigorous content is through scaffolding, right? And scaffolding is just kind of a magic word that encompasses, you know, a wide variety of challenging things. Could you unpack that a little bit for us and talk about rigor and scaffolding, and how we can, support students in doing more rigorous work without just kind of scaffolding the rigor right out of it? Because I think that's possible too.
Well, it is possible. And I think that I'm going to go for a minute to my definition of rigor because I think that's really important and helps us unpack this. I spent over 5 years researching to come up with a definition that was classroom friendly and school friendly. And so my definition of rigor is that rigor is creating an environment in which each student is expected to learn at high levels. Each student is supported so he or she can learn at high levels, and each student demonstrates learning at high levels. So the Common Core is about having those high expectations, and then we have to remember that they need to demonstrate that learning at a high level. So the scaffolding is what comes between, but we cannot ignore those two bookends. So, for example, it is important, increasing text complexity is one of those standards in the Common Core.
Right.
It is important as we are moving to the more complex text that we model our thinking for students. So the first time that they are experiencing, for example, a nonfiction informational text in a science class, then the teacher is going to need to do things like, say, as I'm beginning this, one of the things that I do is I scan the subheadings to see how the article is organized. Another thing that I look for is I skim just the first sentences of each paragraph so that I can get the main idea. But then I go back and I read in depth. And one of the things that I consider is where is the author coming from? What is the author really trying to say? And so, for example, in my notes, I may jot down for each paragraph what I think the author is saying. And if I have a question, I may jot that down also. You know, that's a really simple way of modeling our thinking. And it doesn't take it away from the students, it doesn't read it to them, which would be a way of lessening the rigor. It doesn't tell the students all the answers, but it does show them what that looks like. And on the first time through, I may need to not only talk through it, but show them how I came up with some answers. But I don't need to do that all the time. I may need to do it at the beginning, but I absolutely don't need to do it all the time.
I wonder if we could apply that to students who do have some learning difficulties. And I know you have a book called Rigor for Students with Special Needs, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so when it comes to how students demonstrate their understanding, often, we have different modifications, and even state testing systems sometimes have modification procedures for students with special needs. Could you talk a little bit about what rigor looks like in terms of how students demonstrate their understanding when we know they have learning challenges of some type?
Well, I think one of the first things that we have to think about is our expectations. Our expectations, many times, of students who are labeled are lower. And we've always heard that they can't do or that they just aren't able to do. And so I think our expectations become critical again there. But one of the things that we know is that over half of our students who are labeled with special needs have learning disabilities. And students with learning disabilities typically have average to above average intelligence. So it's not that they can't do it, it's that they need a different approach to the learning. So, for example, if they get to a math word problem, they may not be able to just read that and come up with the answer. So, using a graphic organizer that breaks it down, for example, that has boxes for things like what are the clue words that give you a hint as to what you're going to be doing, such as sum, SUM means you're going to add. A box for what do you know from the problem? What are the given variables? A box for what is the question? One for what's missing? What are the missing variables? And then they solve the problem. What has happened is that it's very similar to a teacher modeling. It's actually chunked all those steps for them, and as they work through them, then they're better able to solve the problem. So, although a graphic organizer may benefit a lot of students, for students with special needs, it is possibly very critical for them to have that and to have that throughout the year. And again, that doesn't mean we're doing the work for them. It means we're providing them a structure that helps them. I think there's a big difference between modifications and accommodations, and the accommodations are those things that the teachers can do in the classroom to really change up the teaching, whether that is additional modeling, whether that is using graphic organizers, it is things like chunking the information. So, for example, if there is a project they are doing and there's 5 steps, just give them 1 step at a time. Show them what the finished product looks like, but instead of just giving them all 5 of the steps, which may be overwhelming, then give them one step at a time and have them complete that so that they can build to having the entire project done. And those are some very effective methods of working with students with special needs. Are they valid for all students? Sure, all students can benefit from chunking. But they're particularly helpful for students with special needs. And again, I'd go back to one of the biggest challenges we have is that we think they can't because they're labeled. And in many cases, they come to us with baggage because of that label. So they've almost given up on themselves. In fact, one of the biggest challenges with students with special needs and other at-risk students is the concept of learned helplessness,
right,
where they have just learned that if they don't try, then we'll help them. And we have to really back off of that and provide support when they need it. But if they're just asking for help because they haven't even tried, then we need to really insist that they try it themselves before we give them help.
You know, one of the ideas I'm picking up there is this idea of heuristics that, you know, often we know how to do something because we have a mental shortcut for it. And our students who are doing very well academically have those kind of thinking patterns and mental shortcuts. You know, they know to look for the word sum to figure out what kind of math problem it is.
Right.
And often we as educators don't think, hey, I need to explicitly teach those heuristics to my students, because we think they should either already know them, or we don't even think that they exist. We don't think about how important it is that we as proficient mathematicians, or you know, whatever we're talking about, are able to kind of scan quickly and find those clues. But I think a big part of what you're saying and a big part of rigor is not taking away the rigor of the task itself, leaving that intact, but figuring out what thinking patterns and what heuristics add up to that ability to do that kind of work, and then teaching those much more explicitly than we normally do.
Well, you're exactly on point, Justin. When I work with teachers in a workshop, one of the things I talk about is prior knowledge. And we all know how important it is to activate prior knowledge. But what we often forget is that there's two types of prior knowledge. There's the content prior knowledge, which is what you know about the content that we're studying. But there's also strategic prior knowledge. So what do you know about the learning strategy, whether that is listening or note-taking or writing an extended response on a test? Working in groups, all of those are strategic knowledge that oftentimes our struggling students don't have. And so, for example, if you ask students who are writing an essay, let's take just a simple essay or an extended response on a test, and you ask students, what are teachers grading? Then they'll tell you that teachers are grading for length. And it's always about length, that they're looking for three paragraphs or they're looking for you to fill up the page. And when I ask teachers what they're looking for, the number one item is quality. Now, sometimes quality is gauged by length, but sometimes a student will throw everything down they know and hope you'll pick out the right part. And that's not what we're looking for. And so there's a disconnect with this strategic knowledge. And so I do think it's important for teachers to identify the learning strategies that they expect students to know, and to model those explicitly and to show them what good looks like. So what does a good extended response look like? Let's look at a sample. Let's try to write a sample. Let's look at that against a criteria. And again, you're not telling them not to write it, but you're teaching them how to write something that is effective. Now, I have teachers all the time who say to me, but that takes time. Yes, it does. But you end up buying back the time over the course of a year, because
right,
if you teach them how to take notes, then you're not having to mess with it all year.
Right, and it's the difference between just asking something students to do something and actually teaching them to do it, and I think that's huge. So let's focus on the role of school leaders for a bit. You have a book called A Toolkit for Leaders, Rigor in Your School, A Toolkit for Leaders, and could you tell us a little bit about how that book is different from your other books, like Rigor is a Four-Letter Word? Tell us about the toolkit.
Yeah, and let's make sure rigor is not a four-letter word, rather than rigor is a four-letter word.
I think I left out a word there, didn't I?
So that one would come off differently, Justin. Okay, so my first book for teachers was Rigor is Not a Four-Letter Word, and it really had gotten that reputation of being a four-letter word. And the focus in it was classroom activities that teachers could use to increase rigor, things they could control within their classroom. Well, very quickly, I had principals in my workshops coming to me saying, but you have to help me. How can I do this school-wide? And so Rigor in Your School, A Toolkit for Leaders, was an outgrowth of those requests. And what it does is focuses on all the school-wide strategies that you can use. So, for example, there's a chapter on culture and how can you impact the culture in your school to increase rigor. And we use a model of breaking that down into some very concrete steps, because I co-wrote the leadership books with Ron Williamson out of Eastern Michigan. And one of the ideas, for example, is an activity called Name It, Claim It, and Explain It. And what you do is, as you are walking through the school, whether you're doing walkthroughs, observations, or just visiting classrooms, if you see something that is an example of rigor, then you take a picture or a video of it. And at every faculty meeting, you start by putting that up on the screen. And you ask the teacher, say, whoever this belongs to, I'd like for you to stand up, name it and claim it as yours, and explain to us what you were doing. Now, be sure to warn the teacher ahead of time. Otherwise, they're a little nervous that you're going to not necessarily be positive about it. So I always recommend you talk to the teacher ahead of time. But what happens is, as you are sharing those positive examples, then the other teachers begin to get ideas and say, oh, okay, that's rigorous. I didn't realize that was rigorous. That's a good idea. Or I hadn't thought about that before, so I might try that. And you're building that culture of success of, we are doing rigor in our school. We just want to do more. And that's a really big thing I see when I'm doing workshops, is that teachers and principals don't believe that they are doing any rigor. So it's either we're doing it or we're not. And it's always in between there. That most schools I'm in, there is some rigor. It's just not as consistent or as much as you want. And so ideas like Name It, Claim It, and Explain It really are very effective for helping build that culture where everyone is increasing the rigor in their classrooms.
Yeah, well, and I think this is a great time as leaders to think about that, because we do have the pressure of Common Core coming up. And, you know, we've seen people kind of take that at different paces, but now that the assessments are actually coming, you know, we're seeing a lot more interest in, in helping students access more complex text and do that that more analytical writing. I think the more we can publicly celebrate good examples, I think that's a, you know, I think that's a terrific example for whatever you're trying to accomplish, is that that public celebration. Excellent.
It is, but it's the number one activity that principals I work with go back and use, and they absolutely love it. So it's a really simple one you can implement tomorrow.
So you've been helping schools with rigor since long before Common Core came along. I wonder if you could talk to us about what you see that's new in Common Core when it comes to rigor, and what's not really new. Because, I mean, obviously, we've had the ability to deliver rigorous instruction for students for many years, and you know, people like yourself have been helping schools to do that for a long time. What do you see that's actually a big change for most schools in Common Core?
Well, I think let's start with what isn't a big change, which is the focus on higher order thinking skills. We have always tried to do that. Certainly some schools are more effective than others. Certain teachers are more effective than other teachers. But that focus on higher order thinking skills has always been there. I think the difference in Common Core is it's made it very explicit. Just like we talked about, the teachers need to make strategic learning explicit for their students. I think what the Common Core has done is make teaching and learning very specific and explicit for teachers. So we said that students should be reading at high levels, but we didn't have a good way to measure what that was. So you had a textbook that maybe said it was for fourth grade or 10th grade, but we had no idea of knowing if that was actually where it needed to be. And one of the things we found with the benchmarks on text complexity with Common Core is that a lot of the reading materials we were using were not at a level of complexity that they really needed to be. So I think it's just made it very plain. I think it's also really emphasized the literacy across the curriculum. Now, again, we have known that, and we've known how important it is in a social studies class to also be using reading skills to learn. But there really wasn't a lot of pressure with it. And now it's one of those things that is no longer optional. We have to do it. And I think that's been the big piece, is to put that accountability with it. And in math, for example, the process skills We've always known we should be using process skills along with the content skills, but in many classrooms that wasn't happening. So I think even though some of these pieces were in place, we've never had it as consistently as we have with the Common Core. And then for some states, it's just a huge jump in the content. That's not true in every state, but in some states, it's a definite step up. And I think what that tells us again is that maybe our expectations were not quite as high as they needed to be. And I know when I was a teacher, it wasn't that I purposely had low expectations. I did the best I could do. But sometimes when I look back, I know that my expectations were not as high as they could have been. And so I think that that's really the biggest thing that Common Core has done, is to make it explicit and to say to us, this is what high expectations really look like in a classroom.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think we've always kind of tried to balance high expectations with accessibility, you know, and I think that's a pressure that's always on teachers. You know, we can teach from a rigorous text, we can have students read, you know, a challenging text, but at the same time, we know we have students who are reading well below grade level, and that that's going to make the lesson more difficult for them. So I think, yeah, it goes back to, you know, to what you said about, you know, when we were talking about scaffolding, about teaching explicitly the strategies that will help students access that text, you know, and get that meaning out of it. So I think that's a big issue and a big opportunity for us as leaders to focus on that.
Right. You
know. Well, Barbara, thanks very much for sharing your insights about rigor and leadership and supporting students, whether they have special needs or not, and whether we're making these changes because of Common Core or just because we need to make them. If people want to learn more about your books and what you do as you work with schools, where can they go?
The best gateway is my website, which is www.barbarablackburnonline.com. Now, don't just put barbarablackburn.com, or you get an author who writes about threat assessments in Washington. So make sure you put Barbara Blackburn online, or you can Google me with Barbara Blackburn and Rigor. But on that, you can connect with me in a variety of ways. You can contact me directly. You can connect with me on Facebook and LinkedIn and Google Plus and Pinterest. You can sign up for my monthly e-newsletter that I do. I do it nine times a year, and it's about a 5-minute read. It's always got tips for teachers, and there's a principal's corner on that. So there's a wide variety of pieces for school leaders. I would say go to the website and click on free resources, and then go to articles. And if you scroll down about a third of the way, you'll see a series of articles that Ron Williamson and I co-wrote for Principal Leadership, and it's on every aspect of our leadership model. And so that's a good set of free resources for you. And also, if you click Rigor on the main website, there's a beginner's guide to Rigor, which is a short little 4-page guide that is very helpful in terms of understanding Rigor in more depth than we were able to go today, because it's filled with classroom examples.
Well, thank you so much. So it's barbarablackburnonline.com to get to the real Barbara Blackburn, right?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. And it's been great talking to you.
Oh, it's been great talking to you, Justin. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. You have a great day.
You too.
Thanks.